This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Father Alberto Ambrosio. He's a Dominican friar and a scholar of Sufism. I spoke with him on June 14th, 2012, at his monastery in Istanbul, Turkey. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org.
Thank you for making the time.
Thank you very much.
Well, Omid told me about you, and we knew we had to come talk to you. Because we listen to Omid. Oh. Take our orders from him.
I just take you to the best of people.
That's right.
All it is. Yeah. And, in the Quran, there's that story of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And there's this, it's a love story. And then there's this bird, the Hopi bird, that just goes back and forth carrying love messages between them. Yeah. And some of the dervishes always say, if you can't be the Queen of Sheba and if you can't be Solomon, at least be the Hopi bird and introduce lovers to each other. So that's, I think, my destiny in life is. And it gets funnier. In Victorian times, when they were translating the story, they translated the Hopi bird as the pimp bird.
Really?
Yes. Apparently, the word pimp had a different connotation back then than it does today.
Well, it's cool again now.
It's cool,
America.
Yeah.
It's a good word now.
Where did you learn your English?
At school. At school, yeah. I don't know if it's enough. For me, it's not enough, but you will be kind with me.
All right, I will be kind with you. And Omid is on mic. I mean, it's really a conversation between us, but I thought if he feels that he wants to jump in and add something.
I think it's a very good
especially
idea.
Especially because you and he have spent a lot of time together here, and he may add something that's essential, so I want his voice to be invited. Are we ready?
And just a quick reminder, if people have cell phones.
Yeah, I left in the other room.
All right. Okay. I want to actually start out by asking you to tell us where we are. Tell us about this building and this location.
We are in a historical part of Istanbul. The Galata neighbor is very important because it was the Genovese neighbor, and because they came with the Crusades. So in this case, it's not a very...
The Genovese?
The Genovese, yeah. And we are really in the Genovese part of the city.
Interesting.
And the Dominican brothers came with the Genovese. Mm-hmm. But I hope they didn't come for the Crusades. I'm sure that they didn't come with them.
Yeah.
And the actual building is in this one where we are is was made in 1928, and the church just behind us is was made in 1984 by the first architect who restored Hagia Sophia. So we are in a very interesting historical place. The Dominicans here spent something like four centuries in Istanbul, in this place, and we are still here. So it's a great sign of the history. But the Dominicans brothers were here even before in another church that was changed into a mosque in 1475.
Right.
So they left there.
Yeah.
And they came here.
And your convent is here now.
Yeah, actually, this room used to be a little chapel where the brothers used to pray because we are in front of the church. So I think because before this decoration of the room, it used to be a kind of room for our dresses and so on.
Okay.
And we changed in a meeting room. But before, it was a chapel.
We drove by a tower, you said, the Italian tower that was 600 years old.
Because of
beautiful.
The Genovese. The Genovese constructed this Galata Tower.
Very beautiful.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful place. I mean,
right.
I love to live here. I love to travel also, but mm-hmm. when I come back here, I'm very happy. Mm-hmm. Because we feel the history, we feel this part of history, Byzantine history. We feel also in our own place, we feel also the Ottoman history. In fact, this place was made in the Ottoman time. Mm-hmm. And this building was made in the Republic time. So, I mean, we can live the history every day, every moment of our daily life.
Right.
So I think it's a very nice place where to live and where to share the cultures, the history, and the religion also. The religions also, because the neighbor used to be an Italian neighbor, but also a Jewish neighbor.
Oh, this was a Jewish neighborhood,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah,
I'm just saying, as you tell me this story, as we came into this neighborhood, it has an Italian feel. I mean, even the cafes. Somehow there's that the tower and the little corner. It's very kind of intimate and busy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. In a way, I feel at home.
Mm-hmm.
Being outside Italy and being somewhere else. I mean, and we have the Italian synagogue just behind this wall. I mean,
really?
And the Ashkenaz synagogue, 200 meters from here. I mean,
and those are still active?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Of course.
Hmm. I'd like to hear just a little bit about you. Did you grow up in Italy?
In Italy.
And tell me about how it was that you came to become a Dominican friar.
I was a normal Italian Catholic. I mean, I used to go to the mass with my mom every Sunday morning, and more or less that's all. I mean, I tried to pray morning and evening prayers. At 18 years old, I felt the love of God. I mean, I can't say more and more and more, but the point is that I felt something that for me is the love of God. And the only answer I could give to this feeling was to offer my life to this love of God that I felt as really powerfully. And for me, it was an evidence. That's why at 18 years old, I decided immediately, behind this feeling, I decided to give my life as Jesuit or Dominicans.
Okay.
When I'm with the Jesuits, I always tell this story because, I mean, they are maybe proud and said, I don't know, maybe if I'm not a good Dominican, they prefer I'm not a Jesuit. But when I'm with Jesuits, and I work a lot with Jesuits, I always say that I felt this feeling, and behind this feeling is I offer my life as a Jesuit or Dominican. And the day after, I went to a bookshop, and everything in my life starts with a book. And I went to this bookshop and asked for a biography of Saint Ignaz or Saint Dominic. And even at the time, I was obsessed by academic books and footnotes and so on. And the biography of Ignaz was not so
Ignatius,
academic.
Ignatius, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other one, neither. But it was a little bit more because I could read the medieval text of the biography of Saint Dominic, and I said, okay, let's go with the Dominicans.
Okay.
So, and 20 years after, I'm still Dominican mm-hmm. brother. And mm-hmm. so I think that this feeling, that is not just a feeling, of course, this vocation, I call it a vocation, is still living in me.
Mm-hmm.
With, of course, different periods, as in life.
Right. As in any relationship or community.
And then I finished the school, and then at 19 years old, I left my family for joining the Dominican Order. The first year was just a kind of trial, of course. I start to study Latin, Greek, and philosophy. And then the second year was more important because it's the year of novitiate, near Florence in a wonderful place, in a wonderful convent. And at the time, I learned, in a way, how to be a Dominican. And then after this time, I spent 6 years studying philosophy and theology in Bologna, where the tomb of Saint Dominic is. And then France for studying Turkish and Oriental languages. And then since 2003, I'm in Istanbul. In brief, my life. When I sum up my life, I say 40 years old, but few phrases, few sentences. It's nothing. I mean,
I could probably get you talking about it for 24 hours if we tried.
Yeah, in a way, yeah.
if we had the time.
Right.
So somewhere in there, you became interested in Sufism, in Islam, in the mystical tradition of Islam,
right.
And in the whirling dervishes in particular.
Of course.
So how did that capture your attention as a Dominican?
As a Dominican, with my vocation, I started also to read Christian and, of course, Catholic mystics. I read a lot. During my formation as a Dominican, I read, and I'm still reading, Christians, mystics as Teresa of Avila, a little bit less John
of the Cross,
and Juliana of Norwich, and so on. And then when we traveled in Jerusalem, we did a kind of pilgrimage in Jerusalem, and northern part of Israel and the south part, and in Jerusalem, I discovered Islam, I discovered the Arabic language, and I discovered more the Muslim believer than the Christian or the Jewish. I mean, it was in 97, and I was more or less finishing my formation as Dominican, and I was trying to imagine my future as Dominican. At the time, I didn't want to go on even in studying. And it was not confused, but I was wondering how it will be my life after. And then this travel, this pilgrimage came up, and I felt something especially with the Arabic language, and I was very surprised by the simplicity of Muslim believers praying outside the mosques and inside. Yeah. And I mean, in a way, I was in love with these people, and I was not interested at all in the Christian sites. I mean, I was not. I mean, when I think even now, this pilgrimage, I think at the believers, the Muslim believers there, and then I came back to Italy, and Turkey, the Dominican houses in Turkey depend on the Dominican province in Italy, which I belong to, and I asked my superior to go to Turkey. And it was kind of a joke. I told him why I couldn't go to in Turkey, and he said, yes, why not? And here I am. I mean,
right.
After 15 years, I'm still here.
And so, did your real study of Sufis at Whirling Dervishes happen here then?
And then after this travel, we chose to study Turkish and Ottoman civilization, and I must to find a kind of topic for a master, for a PhD, and I said, but at the beginning, even at the beginning of my Turkish studies, I took always the options to study Sufi orders, history, or Sufis at the beginning because of my interest in Christian mysticism.
Right,
also.
Right.
So,
and of course, then you were at this center of this heartland of,
of
Islamic mysticism.
Yeah, of course. And then I'm very happy with this topic. That is not just an academic topic, is becoming more, I mean, in a way, for someone can even be very shocking, but becoming more and more experience of life. I mean, I can even think as a Sufi. And I'm shocked because sometimes Christian or Muslims say to me, but you are more a dervish or a Sufi than something else. In a way, I'm very happy. In another way, I'm wondering, am I a good priest or a good Dominican?
You also, though, in coming here, brought yourself to a crucible of Christianity.
Yeah.
I mean, where St. Paul was from.
Yeah.
These resonant names from the Bible, Ephesus. And did you know that, or did you discover that?
I discovered that maybe. At the time, it was more for studying Islam and... Then even now, I mean, I know that it is the country of St. Paul and the very first church history, but I'm more interested in living things, in living people, in living... I'm more interested in doing... Eventually, I'm doing also this. I'm more closer to the Christian, the living Christian community here than a history that in a way is finished. I mean... I know that there are some pilgrimage here to the St. Paul's places, but in a way, it's just stones for me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm more interested in living beliefs here as a Christian or as a Muslim.
So let's talk about what that's like for you, this life you have of... you know, being immersed in the meditative tradition of Christianity and really living also this meditative tradition of Islam. I mean, maybe one place to start is yesterday I interviewed Jemal Noor, and we talked about love and how that is the essence for her of Sufism. But I, you know, at one point I asked her to talk about what word she's using. Because love is kind of in English, it's just it doesn't connote that this mystical experience of love. But I'd be so interested in, you know, what you learn. Just think about that. When you said at 18 you experienced the love of God, and this then took over your life. I don't know. What do you get from both of these traditions about that thing that we call love? That
I was till last summer, or till last October, I was Catholic oriented thinking about the love of God in Islam and in Sufism. Because in general, and we had even the Pope talked a little bit in this really famous talk in German that Islam is in a way violence. That means for me, in another point of view, that something is violence means that it's not love. So I kept in my mind this idea. And I knew that a Christian tradition of interpreting Islam shows that in Islam or even in Sufism there's no space for love. And I had to give a course in Rome about the love of God in Christian mysticism and in Sufism, and no student, so the course was up. I mean, no student, no
one enrolled.
But I brought an article for a conference, and I found maybe the best part of my discoverings in the last months, in the last years, because by Rumi and by the author I studied for a great commentator of Rumi, a whirling dervish who lived in 17th century, I discovered some wonderful text on love and the love of God. And in a way, we can share even the idea of love of God as considered by Catholic charity. Because Rumi and Ankaravi, the author, say that the love of God, the love, mm-hmm. is boundless. Mm-hmm. And boundless means also something that is very without no limit, without no interest, and this is also charity.
So it's overflowing, it spreads itself.
And I think that in this concept, we can meet even Muslim and Christian.
Right, because, so for Jamal Noor, there's this connection between love and love and civic life, even love and knowledge, love and service, which is what you're saying.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Actually, the question is how I perceive the love mm-hmm. of God mm-hmm. more than, but knowing that I have also a background in Sufi studies, maybe I don't know. The love of God is God Himself. I mean, I know that. In my creed, and it's not just in my creed, it is in my life that God is love.
Right.
And
so really the emphasis on is, that yeah. is, God is love.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. And I felt this, but God is love, but I felt also the love of God. So I know that God can show Himself as justice or the one who is revealed to the woman and to the man in the world. And at the time, I felt as love of God, and I'm still feeling this. It's not so simple as that at the time, mm-hmm. because God loves also to show Himself and to hide
uh-huh. Himself. So the word is, in English is a little bit flat. It's,
yeah.
So, you speak how many languages? I don't know.
Four. Let's say four.
Okay. So I'm just curious, are there better words? Are there other languages that actually capture what you, this love that you've discovered in faith and both in Christianity and also in Sufism.
Especially about love.
Yeah,
love.
I mean, as a
that is experience of.
Yes, as opposed to just the English word love. Does something else do it better for you?
Even in English or in another language?
Yeah, in English or in other languages. Mm. Or do other languages do it better?
Yeah, I'm Sufi oriented now. Yeah. The first word I'm thinking about to tell something of this feeling, but would be Ashk.
Right, Ishk. This is... Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's that Jamal Noor talked about Ashk. And because of this article, I found really the deepness of the concept of Ashk, mm-hmm. That is a boundless love. And in this way, I think it is kind of the right word in Christian tradition mm-hmm. Of charity. Mm-hmm. Charity is the love of God.
Like an outpouring of
yeah, love. But charity, when you say charity, you think to do something for people, poor mm-hmm. people. But the charity is the real love of God. So I think in a way charity is mm-hmm. the Ashk, okay. because it's boundless, and the charity is also boundless mm-hmm. love.
So what else do you discover? At this boundary you live at, this spiritual boundary between Islam and Christianity. I mean, are there things you learn about Christianity because of your proximity to Islam or vice versa?
Both, at least both. I mean, I found a lot of things. I found Islam and Sufism, or Sufism and Islam, or this Islam according to the Sufi, that is a real Islam, And so I found something very special of Islam by the Sufis. Mm-hmm. So, and I want to keep as a speciality for them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time,
So we're talking typical. About Sufism as opposed to just Islam.
But mm-hmm. At the same time, by studying and by discovering this Sufism, I discovered something in my Christian tradition that I didn't know, or I didn't know in the same, in another way. Mm-hmm. So I can recognize the differences between the two faith and traditions, but I can say that there are some proximities, and I even don't like to think in this way. I mean, I think that there is a human communion between mm-hmm. believers.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't like to leap to commonalities either, but then there's something different when you go very deep, when you're living deeply inside your tradition, and you encounter the depths of another.
Yeah. And...
I'm just curious about what you hear there or what you see there. That,
as a Christian of the other, the
yeah, either one. I mean, what do you learn there in those deep places where?
Mm-hmm. I learned another word. In a way, another world, another universe, spiritual and human, that I can't judge. I cannot judge because, in a way, they are different. It's different, this universe of human behaviors. I mean, in a way, I discovered another human behaviors, eventually under that, there is a very closed human behavior to mine. Mm-hmm. Another word, because Islam faith is, in a way, another God, in a way. Mm-hmm. And I like also to think God as the oneness, the absolute oneness. And this, I mean, I felt the difference of, I felt the communion of human beings, but mm-hmm. I realized that as human beings, we can also be different.
Yes.
Being in communion. Mm-hmm. I mean, is another, and a faith can really model a creature in a different way.
Right.
The creed and the experience, another religious experience, can model another the creature, the man and woman, different from my experience.
So I sense that you want to resist saying it's all the same in a way out of reverence for both traditions. Is that right? And I really understand that. I really appreciate that. So you're saying at one and the same time, you experience the oneness of God. And you still want to hold Allah and God as different in some way.
Right, of course.
Yeah. And those aren't in contradiction.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's why the contradiction makes me to be really alive, but at the same time, it's a little bit... I mean, I'm tired. It's making me tired.
It's exhausting.
Exhausting, yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's a kind of virus. One of my professors of theology told me that interreligious dialogue, intercultural experience is like a virus. And when you took this virus, you can't be without this virus. It's
I also think
living virus.
There's a paradox in really profound interreligious encounter,
right?
Which I think is the world doesn't really understand. I mean, people, which is that it's not an you people go are as deep or more deeply planted in their own tradition,
right.
And can be just appreciative and reverent towards the other in a way that they couldn't have imagined before.
Right.
And you're really living in that place, which sounds like a contradiction between identity and reverence, but it's not.
Yeah, and that's why my worst suffering is the fact that some other brothers or some other Catholics couldn't understand this living contradiction, this contradiction that makes me really alive, and it's a wonderful paradox.
Yeah. I also think, though, that the West in the last 50 years tried, to created that contradiction between strong identity, that you had to be tolerant and that meant muting a strong identity, or you had a strong identity and you weren't tolerant. And I think, actually, you're 40 years old. I mean, I think that wasn't humanly sustainable.
Right.
It wasn't spiritually, it didn't have spiritual integrity. And so the new generations are finding ways to combine those things. And you maybe really represent that living here in Turkey, which is a place.
Yeah.
Historically and in the present, that lives with that paradox.
Yeah, I think so. In a way, you completely right. In a way, I'm maybe the real product of Western mentality that leaves this paradox, this contradiction. But at the same time, as I told before, I love this contradiction. And maybe it's not a real contradiction. I mean, this mentality represents this experience as a contradiction, but it's not. Maybe it's not. And I'm sure that it's not, because as I told you before, I'm closer to the idea of human communion, human meeting, than this identity. I mean, I know that I'm a Catholic and I want to be a real Catholic. And even with my background in philosophy and theology, I studied a lot Thomas of Aquinas, that is the doctor of a Catholic Church. And I'm still very close to this philosophy and theology. But at the same time, I can be open-minded to see what God creates and created and still creates in the world in terms of religions, faith, and human beings. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't imagine that God... it's not a problem of revelation. I can't imagine that God can keep together different religions. I mean, it's own choice.
That God can what? Can
keep together and create it. Different religions. I mean, is an old theology. Even in medieval age, we had this kind of interpretation. But I think it's because God is the creator; he can also create different religions.
Right.
I mean, I'm still wondering and questioning myself.
Yeah.
And I like to be open.
Right. Now, Turkey is also a place where Christianity is very much diminished, at least in numbers, right? Think that's also a history you know and are part of. So would you tell a little bit of that story of Christianity here in this place?
Yeah, it's... for certain way, is it's a sad story because especially at the end, by the end of Ottoman Empire, the very
in the early 20th century,
and the beginning of the Turkish Republic history, the Christians were I can't say persecuted, but they left Turkey. They left, and there were a lot of problems. The exchange of population between Greeks and Turks, and then the big problem of Armenians and so on.
Right,
and actually, the Christians here are more or less 100,000.
So right, and it, but it used to be 50% of the population were non-Muslims anyway, right?
It used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it used to be even in Istanbul. Istanbul was a Christian town till the probably the 40s or.
Really?
Yeah, the majority of population in Istanbul, I think, till the 30s was Christian.
And now?
And now not. Now maybe, the 99.9% of
Muslim.
Population is Muslim, or let's say Turks.
Right, right.
Better than Muslim, but mm-hmm. ex-Turks
Turks
also
are
Muslim.
Not Christian, right.
It's a big question, this. I mean, I think the problem is the difference, how to... let difference live in this country. Not just the Christians. Christian is just an example. Right. But the problem is difference. Mm-hmm. Even Sufi
and
can
even
be considered as mm-hmm. different from
right.
some other groups or some other interpretation of the Turkishness or the nationalists and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So even Alevis or Kurdish can be considered as other.
Right.
It's a big issue.
Well, there's even the tension between secular Turks and and devoutly
yeah,
Muslim Turks.
Yeah, of
mm-hmm.
course.
Mm-hmm.
And for Christianity is just a result of this mentality and the left, and they still continue to leave Turkey. Some of them try to come back to Turkey. Some of Syrians in the southeast of Turkey, they come back and they try to settle again. Or we have some other foreign Christian who are
right.
coming into Turkey.
I mean, do you experience this as a source of grief?
Not really. Especially in Istanbul, we are free, and we are not in any way persecuted. We have some difficulties, of course. As a Catholic, Latin Catholic Church, we are not recognized in a juridical point of view. And this is, in a way, is the grief for the Latin Catholic Church and for some other churches, because even this building is as the property of Dominicans, but I can't show exactly that it is, and you exist and you don't exist at the same time in the same way. This is a kind of grief, but it's not a grief that I can't live here or I can't live very well. I can live very well, but at the same time I've some difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not the only one who can have some difficulties
right.
in this country.
You don't
as
feel
a
singled
different...
out. And then, of course, you're kind of touching on this without naming it. The other boundary that you live at here is that the Christians, that the tradition that is prominent but also centered here is the Eastern Orthodox Christianity.
Yeah, right.
Right.
At least for in historical terms.
Mm-hmm. Right, in historic times. But still the ecumenical patriarch
here,
is based here. This is, for Greeks, still Constantinople.
Yeah,
and the Patriarch Bartholomew, part of his title, is Archbishop of Constantinople
right.
and New Rome.
Yeah, right. I'm very proud because when I met him, every time I met him, he talks to me in Turkish.
Uh-huh.
So I'm very proud of this because, of course, he knows Italian, English, French, and we could talk in another Western languages.
Mm-hmm.
And but because he knows that I can also talk in Turkish, and probably he's happy that I can talk in Turkish because it's not very common between priests, Catholic priests, So, and I tell everyone that he talks to me in Turkish.
Well,
so,
but say some more about why that matters, why that's important.
Because he feels, probably he feels, I mean, it's my interpretation, maybe mm-hmm. it's not right, but he feels that I'm here and I want to be here. I want to be a part of this country, as they are also a part of country, as an old old part of this country, as Greek Orthodox is a really old part of this country.
Yes.
Is an old tradition. And so he want, probably he wants to see me as the same perspective, to be here, not just a foreigner, but to be here as a part of the country.
Of even,
I felt this.
Even predating the Ottoman.
Yeah,
right. So
probably, yeah.
Truly.
Yeah, because we were, yeah. The
yes.
Dominicans'
yes.
history here
Christians
is very long.
Yes.
But they didn't talk Turkish. I mean, it's a very recent story that even Catholic priests can talk in Turkish. They mm-hmm. didn't learn Turkish for centuries.
Right.
For centuries.
Right. And there were so many reasons that the Eastern and Western Church, or the Eastern and the Latin Church, or the Orthodox and the Latin churches, let's get our politically correct, like that they diverged. But one of them was also that Roman Catholic theology was happening in Latin and Orthodox theology was happening in Greek. So I mean, even the language.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
So the fact that you can speak in Turkish now,
yeah,
is interesting.
Maybe.
It's interesting.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So I have a quick question. So, Albert, I know you say that you don't look at stones, you look at living communities,
yeah.
right? And that's true even when you're looking at the tradition of St. Paul and the early
yeah,
churches.
Right.
I'm wondering, you know, when you look at the churches in Istanbul, that used to be churches and then are converted over to mosques. Yesterday we were at Koçak Ayasofya and, you know, Ayasofya and all these
wonderful.
lovely places. I know you don't look at stones.
Yeah, I look, but...
Right. But if you're in a place like this and you see, you can tell
yeah.
from the altar
yeah,
pattern
yeah, right.
and the cross pattern that it was a church and then there's a prayer niche added. Is there a... sentiment? Is there a yearning? Is it just a neutral observation?
Yeah, since the beginning, when even when I was in Santa Sofia, neutral, really neutral. And
really?
I'm sometimes shocked because I feel that the others don't have my own feeling. Neutral because in a way I'm very reconciliated with the history. I mean, history is a part of revelation of God. I mean... I can't say yeah. If I had this place, it's history. I mean, and history has something very is very powerfully and because history before being history was reality, was living life. Because I love life, living life. I would say, I think the history of as a living life at a time,
right.
not like stones.
And this is your time.
Yeah. So I can understand that time and this time because of idea of life, not as history, dead history. It's not
mm-hmm.
dead history.
Mm-hmm.
It was life at the time, not history. So for me, nothing. I don't have any kind of, it's okay. There was a conquest, okay.
Right.
And the conquest was not just because of the Bad Turks,
mm-hmm.
but also Greeks and Italians, the Venetians and Genovese were not really
all the good guys.
Yeah,
right. Right. But this history between different Christians is also very troubled. I mean, when you said a minute ago, when you went to Jerusalem for the first time in your 20s, I think, and you were not attracted to the Christians there.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Jerusalem. We went to Jerusalem. Our show went there last year for the first time, and I was disturbed by the Christians there.
Mm-hmm. So I was you can understand me.
I understand you. I saw the anguish of the Palestinians and the Israelis, yeah. and you can take all of that apart. The Christians I found were sour and, you know, divided among themselves. A Palestinian said to me that he thinks of Jesus as a Palestinian, that he's a Muslim, but that he reveres Jesus as a Palestinian figure and the purest example of teaching of a peacemaker that is in their history and in the history of that region. But I did not experience the Christians in Jerusalem to be peacemakers, even among themselves, yeah. right? They didn't speak. They don't worship together. They can't worship together. Yeah. I don't know. So
yeah, this is you talked before as a grief. I think it's one of my griefs to see, especially Oriental churches, this situation.
Yeah. And when you say the Oriental churches, you mean the Eastern, the Orthodox.
Eastern, pardon.
The Eastern Orthodox.
Armenian, the different, so on.
Yes,
yeah,
Armenian,
because as
Russian,
Latin, we have another approach even to the faith. The Eastern churches are more pious. I mean, more devotees, and it's not really the Latin approach to the practices. But finally, every Sunday morning I go to another parish, Dominican parish, where I celebrate in Turkish for my community that is composed by Eastern Christians.
Really?
So
mm-hmm.
yeah, from Turkey. Mm-hmm. I mean, Chaldeans, Syrian Catholic, Syrian Orthodox.
Right.
And living with them, at least on Sunday morning, I finally felt their approach to the faith, to the religion, and even if I don't like, this kind of apology of Eastern churches because the believers from Eastern church are more believers than the Latin Catholic, for example, because they kept the real faith and so on.
But the Latin Catholics had that same.
Yeah.
yeah. Right. Yeah.
So, I learned to appreciate them for their simple faith and not for this division, this appearances of communities, because they love to show themselves as one community, rich community, mm-hmm. well organized and so on, mm-hmm. or not well organized. In some cases.
So that experience of the parish has been more important for you in terms of connecting with
yeah,
that history
right.
between Eastern
right.
and Western
yeah.
Latin. And
I can understand them. I can understand, mostly I can understand the discourse mm-hmm. about persecution.
Mm.
I mean, it's not a taboo. I mean, now for me, it's not a taboo because I spend with them sometimes listening to them. And their discourse about persecution, we were, and sometimes we are still persecuted. And I finally discovered that, in a way, it's a kind, just a discourse. They needed this kind of discourse, probably even to create their identity mm-hmm. here. But behind this discourse, they try to have a simple faith and a real, and they are, in a way, they are closer to the Muslim believers than they can imagine
well,
because of the culture, the religious
right,
culture
culturally.
It's very common. Mm-hmm. It's more common than we can imagine. Sometimes I can even say this, that sometimes when I listen to a Christian sermon, I have the impression, even if I don't go to listen to the preacher in the mosque, I know the moral discourse of the Islam, so I can think that it's more or less the same.
Mm-hmm.
The Christian sermon in a Sunday morning, or
the Muslim sermon in this. That is such an interesting.
But I can say all these things, but I know that I can show myself as contradictory, I know. And paradoxically, but if you want to hear something of living experience, this is my living experience. I mean, I know if I have to write a more academic article, you won't read this.
You won't, yeah.
Because an editor wouldn't accept.
But it is one of the interesting, what did you say about history? I mean, the history in our time, this time we live in, it's an interesting reality of Christianity globally, that so many of these ancient places of Christianity, the biblical places, are Muslim cultures now. Yeah. And that there is this closeness, or at least there's a shared culture, as you're describing, whether it's conscious or not.
The culture is more or less the same. The culture and the religious culture also is more or less the same. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't want to say this, but they lived, all them lived in the same place. So
for hundreds and hundreds of years,
century.
You gotta change it. Oh, battery. Yeah, I thought we didn't have to change it.
A battery.
Do you want to ask another question? You can. Okay.
I will say I've almost never heard whenever there is a division in a faith tradition, Latin and Orthodox, Sunni and Shi'i, Theravadan and Mahayana, I've never heard the followers of one sect or division describe the other side as more pious. this is a first time experience for me, you know. So.
I mean, I do sense that you're also because of what your studies and your interests, your theological interests. For you, it's the encounter with Islam and with Sufism that's been more powerful, and it's just been the more focus of your attention. But in terms of living here and at the center in Constantinople, I mean, is there also something in that at that level of, at that more official level of?
Yeah,
the Eastern Orthodox, the Eastern Western split in Christianity that is interesting for you, or is it just there?
No. Yeah, of course, it's interesting also to see how the official positions and politics go on. I mean, in this world, in this period of history. And I finally have to say that we reproduce very often the same problems mm-hmm. of the past. Mm-hmm. More or less the same interpretation of the past we are reproducing now in another way, but the question of persecution. Maybe we don't say that it's a persecution, but we or some other Christian here, some other problems. It's interesting for me, in a neutral point of view, to see how the official positions are considered and held. Mm-hmm. By politician or by...
And you as an Italian from the center of Latin Christianity.
Also.
You've seen the other the other side of it.
Uh-huh. Also, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
So in America, and I think to some extent in Western Europe, 9/11 was this watershed, right? We live in the post-9/11 world.
I began to have... fear of flights because
of flying. Is that true for you too? Because Turkey is a different center, right? I mean, it's both European and...
Yeah, of course.
So is that, aside from fear of flying, I mean, is that a milestone for you psychologically, or even in terms of how you see religion in the world?
For me or in
general?
Yeah,
for you. 9/11 is...
Thank God that I began this adventure of discovering another religion, another country, another tradition before 9/11. I mean, I started in 96, and I remember exactly because I was studying religions, and I'm still surprised that I did this in 92, when I was a young Dominican student as a brother. I had 6 months Islam course, 6 months Hinduism course, 6 months Judaism. So in a time, a very strange time, without no problem, I was studying Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, and Judaism.
Right.
So thank God that I found that I could study in a very neutral or very curious point of view religions. And I remember that I studied very well the course of Islam. And then 96, and I remember exactly a conversation I had in a train with a Dominican brother, and he was the guy who learned to me to switch on Islamic mystical traditions. But at the time, we were coming back from Jerusalem.
Yeah, what do you mean to switch on?
I mean, he said to me, we went back from Jerusalem, and we were going to we were going home. And we were together in the train, and we were talking about, he was also interested in spirituality, mystical tradition, and so on. We're talking, and he said to me, if I had to go in a Muslim country, or he was talking in general, and he said to me, if I had to go to Jerusalem again, I would study Islamic mysticism.
Okay.
Because he said, because I think that there must be an Islamic mysticism.
Okay.
And
he
I
didn't
kept
even
in mind,
yeah.
It's the
yeah.
beginning for
he
me.
He turned you on to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so my decision to be more involved, engaged with studying Islam, and to be in Turkey, mm-hmm. begin before 9/11. Thank God, because otherwise, of course, it changed a little bit, but not a lot. I mean, actually, I treat every kind of, as a Christian, as a Dominican, as a European,
mm-hmm.
I think that in a political point of view, I treat all Islam, all kind of Islams as the same. Of course, I prefer the Sufi mm-hmm. Way to live Islam,
mm-hmm.
but I don't want to show that there is just one Islam. I think there are kinds of Islams possible.
Yes.
Living Islams, and I can't show that the Wahhabi Islam or Salafi Islam is the only one, because it's not the historical truth.
You
of
know
Islam.
The diversity of you've li- yeah. been living with
and
the diversity
I think
of
that
Islam.
As a even as a
right.
Christian, I have a duty to show the richness of Islams. Of course, an Islam believer can't say like me, but I can say this
mm-hmm.
or. A very intelligent as Omid can say that Islam is not one Islam, and I hope that he can't. But in general, I can accept that a Muslim believer says Islam is one, of course, but because God is one.
Right.
But as a Christian, as I can't say this
okay.
because
I
see, I study the
it's
the
not
history.
Your experience.
Yeah, it's
mm-hmm.
not my experience.
Mm-hmm. This is not really a religious question, but you know, you are Italian. You're from Western Europe. Turkey has become newly so interesting since the Arab Spring. It's another
right.
milestone. And how do you think about this concept of, you know, Turkey, this as country a as a democracy and as a model for emerging is democracies and with Muslim cultures? Do you think about that?
It's a model. I mean, in a way, it's a model. They worked a lot for Turkey to be a model. In a way, it could be, but not just the model, because in this way, the Arab culture is not the Turkish culture.
Right.
And it can't work. I mean, as a real model.
You can't just translate it home.
No, mm-hmm. I don't think mm-hmm. so. Mm-hmm. The Turkey model is a model because they can show that they succeeded in composing between democracy and religions, mm-hmm. religion mm-hmm. or religions.
Mm-hmm. Do you have another question? Amir, what have you been thinking about while we're talking?
I mean, one question I have is, I know that a lot of you're very involved in interfaith dialogue, this virus, as you sometimes call it, and you participate in a lot of them, and people also look to you for helping shape these conversations. And so much of the conversation is at the institutional level, at the theological level.
Right.
With various results, sometimes more beneficial than others. I'm wondering if you had the chance to start a process of bringing people together of different faiths who are committed to their own tradition but open to others. What would it look like? Who would take part in it, and what would they do? Would they sit around the table? Would they read scriptures? Would they pray together? What would that conversation look like?
For the moment, the best experience I have is the previous degree is talking. When I talk about Sufis, for example, to an audience, a Western and Christian audience, and then questions start to come up, and then I encourage people to read text of Sufism, and I try to also to transmit my own feelings through the Islam and Sufism, for example. Actually, I think the best part, I mean, it can be to read together. I'm dreaming to read together text of different traditions, but it's still a kind of dream, because I have to find the people who won't really do that. But I'm, in a way, I'm trying to prepare people to that.
And are you talking about scripture or other texts, mystical texts?
Yeah, right.
Other texts.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes people start with the Quran and the Bible, and that's not the place to start.
I'm afraid also.
It seems obvious, and it's not. It's actually the worst place to start.
I'm very happy because I have to write a book of introduction to Islam for a Christian audience, but very simple, using poetry and so on. Mm. And is a Catholic publisher that asked to me to do this. And I brought also a book, the first Italian book on whirling dervishes, and it's more and more...
The whirling dervishes, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was the first one, even if a lot of Italians come to Turkey and see and the whirling dervishes dance, and they don't know, they go back and they don't still know anything about Sema. And apparently this book is very well received, mm-hmm. but even by by the church, I was very, I mean, a little bit proud, because the Cardinal Ravasi, who is the Minister of Culture, did a very good book review in one of the most important newspapers in Italy about a book. And he loves also Rumi's poetry. Hmm. That is very interesting.
So why is it that that these fundamental texts of our theologies and traditions are not the place to start, and that poetry and mystical texts are the place to start? Why is that?
I have a lot of answers about this, because the texts are like, I don't know, like idols.
Are the Bible and the Quran?
Yeah, in a way, I can't go very close to them, because
right. It's
very dangerous. And poetry, mystical poetry, are very closer to us, more close.
They're hospitable to outsiders. Also,
there is something. It's like a saint for Catholic, a saint. That's I can understand why this devotion to the saints in Catholicism, especially in Catholicism, because the saints are human beings and closer than even Christ or God Himself. Mm-hmm. So we need. Simple experiences, and especially Rumi poetry is very the images that used by Rumis are very simple, very our experience. People
accessible. Need
accessible. Mm-hmm. People need this, mm-hmm. and mostly now in these days we need simple way to find God and His love. And the experience of God. Mm-hmm. Simple ways.
So I think even 20 years ago, I remember I was involved with some Benedictines who do ecumenism, which is one of
wonderful.
Their things. And there was a big discussion about including this to interreligious dialogue. Mm. And the thing is, whether it was true or not, 20 years ago, it felt like a choice. Right, whether any tradition wanted to be interreligiously active. And in 2012, it doesn't, right? The world is interreligious, it's interconnected. I mean, you've been living this for a long time. And of course, in a place like Turkey, I mean, it's always been a reality. But so what do you think? I think it's very frightening for a lot of people. It is new. It's new for human beings to be living with this kind of proximity to religious others in some places.
Right.
I mean, in the United States, much more religiously diverse now than it was 30, 40 years ago for all kinds of reasons. So what do you think, from this perspective, this vantage point you have, what would you say about, where you have concerns, but most importantly, like, what are your sources of hope as you see this world unfolding, where more and more people are going to be living the way you do, very close to another tradition, also committed to their own?
But they don't want. I mean, they don't want to leave this diversity.
Well,
it's going
to happen. So what have you learned that might be useful?
It's a fact, but...
It's a fact, yeah.
But...
It can be frightening.
Yeah.
And it's new. It's right.
It's new.
It's change,
new, right.
And change is stressful for human beings.
And you're asking me the kind of solution, how to leave this.
What can you offer that you know? And what about the experience you've had? I think there are often a lot of scenarios of how badly it can go wrong. And so
I think that it's an art. It's an art to live this diversity. And we cannot hide that there are also some dangers. Mm-hmm. And the first problem for everything, and especially in this topic, is not to recognize the dangers. And how to escape by the dangers is to learn the art of living with diversities, living with in this context. And when I say the art to live with, I think that, for example, sometimes, even if I like this virus of interfaith and so on, I need to have a break and to look at myself, to look at my God, my faith, to have a kind of, to have a breath, to have a break, and to, for meditate, maybe just for meditating what I lived before or what I can do after. And this is an art, as silence and word. Sometimes there is a time for talking, for conversation, and there's for dialogue, and there is a time for silence, for meditating what I lived before. Yeah. So I think the real answer to this fear, that is a real fear, is to learn the art how to live together with diverse religious diversity. Mm-hmm. I'm learning too. I mean, I'm trying to learn.
And as you look around you here or in the world, you know, where do you see, what are sources of hope for you or inspiration? Where you say, yes, that's what it can be like.
For these topics, of course.
Yeah. The living with.
I think that I think and I feel that there is some very interesting experiences in the Western countries, probably even in the United States, probably in England also, not a lot in the Latin part of Europe. And probably in some places like Lebanon, more than Turkey, because in Lebanon it's a real, it's an obligation to live together, or the war, I mean.
Right.
And they are trying, I had a very good experience with the interfaith group in Turkey, coming from Lebanon. And I was there also for conferences, and I felt always a very good feelings. And they want to go on with interfaith reflections. I think that it could be, and it can be also in Turkey. In Turkey is a little bit lesser organized. I feel this with the Sufi groups. I think that it's a beginning. Of course, in Turkey, we have also official conferences about interreligious dialogue, interfaith, but it's more official.
Yeah.
But I think also in Turkey, it could be a very good place where to do an experience with live together with the diversity. Another field, but it's not a living, I think. Novels, literature
really?
Is also I think is inspiring me a lot, and I'm still reading not a lot but quite a lot novels, and I'm very surprised how this kind of problems, let's say a problem or topic, is a topic of novels. I read last month. I read. A lot of novels written in French, but by Muslim believer or with a background in, and always, and not just by Muslim believer, but also by French, is a kind of obsession to live the difference,
To live the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the topic of a lot of novels. Mm-hmm. And I read this wonderful novel that was advised by a friend of mine, a Muslim, The Girls of Riyadh. Have you heard of it?
The Girls of Riyadh?
Riyadh.
I feel like maybe I've heard. Who's that by?
Al-Saniya Raja, a wonderful novel. Mm-hmm. And it's about the Saudi society and the woman and the Saudi society, and they're also a kind of for women to live the differences or to change. I read some translation of Iranian novel. I have to remember now. I began to forget, and I wrote an article that will be published maybe tomorrow or next few days for an important newspaper about, it's a kind of interpretation by these novels of the veiled woman in Islam. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that behind the veil of Islam, there are really women. Living, acting, and proposing something for the societies.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how we tend to focus so much on things at a political level, but it may be, in fact, in novels and in art. That,
yeah,
and
I think so.
It's always happened in human history, but we forget this.
Yeah, it's let the politics do their job. I mean, if I can do something else, I will do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if I can do in order to change also this level, why not? But I can't wait. I mean, it's my life. I can't wait. I can't wait that everything change. If I can change with, if I can begin with my life. Yeah. So I can't wait my death to see something changing around me. If I can change now around me.
I think that's your last word. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Before we stop, I just want to get a little bit of a...
Oh, also, would you say your whole name for me? I just want to hear you say it.
Alberto Fabio Ambrosio.
Okay.
Just 30 seconds or so. Just the
room. Of what?
The room.
Just to record the room. Okay. For about 30 seconds.
I think Jamal Noor would approve of us listening to the room, giving the room its due.
I want to, it's the only room a little bit oriental. I wanted to do some to have a Turkish oriental sound and taste.
No, it's here. Great. Yeah.
Otherwise, it's Latin everywhere. I mean, you can be in Italy here, in the church.
Well, the birds provide a wonderful soundtrack, you know.
Yes, thank you. I don't have one, but
it's enough.
I bet this. Thank you so much.
You want?
Yes,
thank you.
I have one. Thank you.
I can offer you a coffee. Can I have coffee?
Interesting.
At 1 o'clock, I have the
meal. Yeah,
but I can do it.
Should I come with you to help you prepare?
No, I can come here.
Yeah? Okay.
You need something else?
No, I think we're good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to... Chris was just wondering about seeing the church.
I was wondering if we have any interest in seeing the church, having a comment, walk us through, if they've been yet there.
1240?
Yeah. Probably not. Yeah. Oh, it's 1240.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Okay.
That's great.
Yeah. It's very...